without further ado, I'm going to pass on to Phil. Welcome to Sheffield Hallam. I know Phil's been here a number of times before. I've heard very good reports about his session, so I'm really looking forward to working with you this morning, Phil.
Thanks very much, Alison. Right, well, good morning, folks. And it's good to be back here at Sheffield Hallam. Also, you notice there are people recording the session, and I'm mic'd up as well. They want to put this on the alumni website, so I'll be repeating into the microphone sometimes things that you say, etc. So anyone who's now listening on the alumni website in the future, welcome to this session about learning. Right, well, I'm Phil Race, as you can tell, and I'm retired now. I don't belong to anywhere, but I've got connections to one or two places. Plymouth is about as far as you can get on one train from Newcastle, obviously coming through Sheffield. I'm through Sheffield just about every week, actually, if I'm on my way to somewhere else. Also got connections with one or two places a bit further away than Plymouth, but that takes a plane to get there. But I've got to put from Newcastle upon Tyne on my slide because people wouldn't know where I lived just looking at that list of places. And I always remind people, you know, why it's called Newcastle. It's because we have a new castle, basically, which you can see from the end of the central station, which the Victorians kindly didn't demolish when they built the central station, and looks like that. It's been there since 1068, that bit, replacing the older castles. There's about the third one on the site. There was a castle there in Roman times as well. So, that's me. This is normally my second slide. Is that one all right with everyone? if you're filling in your FHEA things, you know, that'd be a really valuable slide to append to. But it really has three purposes. Did this one before you came in to check that the focus, because small print is much easier to focus these things than large print. Persuade people at the back to come nearer if they want to, and persuade people never to use slides like that other than to focus the data projector. For those of you who are listening to the recording of this, these slides, the main slides, will be up on my website after about lunchtime today. So if you want to see the slide that everybody's chuckling about, you will be able to. That's my life history on one slide. I think many of you have heard me say bits about that in the past. How many of you have been to things I've done before? Oh, not too many. Right. Basically, Hail from the North East. The thing I know most about is music. How many of you are musicians? One or two nods. I play two things, the iPlayer and the CD player. I can play those reasonably well. I have got a piano waiting for me. My wife bought me one on my 60th birthday to try to keep me at home a bit more. And I can play all the right notes. It's just the order and the timing that's the problem. Now, I'm left-handed and have terrible handwriting, so I had to be a scientist. Any of you scientists? Nobody from science backgrounds? One or two? I got loads of grief from English teachers and history teachers for bad handwriting. I got no trouble at all from chemistry, physics and maths teachers. They were just too pleased somebody could do chemistry, physics and maths, I think. So I became a physical chemist. But the reason I'm standing here today is I went to Wales way back in 1971 where they needed a lecturer in physical chemistry, but they also needed a warden of their hall of residence. So for the first 8 years in Wales, I lived with 100 students and watched their faces getting sadder and paler and longer with assessment and got more and more interested in teaching and learning and study skills and all that sort of thing. So I gradually stopped being a scientist and ended up as Prof of Educational Development. Attempted to retire way back in 1995, went back to the Northeast, but since then I've been a foot in the door at Durham for 4 years, 1 day a week, 2 days a week at Leeds for 5 years, then 2 days a week at Leeds Met until they threw me out when I reached the age where you've got to be thrown out, so I'm now completely free, as it were. But I do know quite a lot about train timetables because I'm always on them. I know when they should run, not when they do run, of course. And I'll be back there later on today again. And just an acknowledgement to students. I still work with students when I ever get the chance, most recently down at Plymouth, in fact. And a little message from New Zealand just to remind us that students are actually ahead of us. And I think that's how it should be. I'll just test out whether my technology works as well there. You might have seen this.
1 minute, please. sorry, you're too late. Gave you plenty of warnings about time. You failed. Sorry. Excuse me, do you know who I am? I had absolutely no idea. Good.
When I put the slides on my website, obviously I can't put that up because I don't own the copyright for that, but anybody who wants to find it, I think it's called Do You Know Who I Am? On YouTube, you'll find it quite easily. Right. And people do ask me, what does emeritus mean? And something like this, someone who survived an academic career without being thrown out for reasons like that. Both Leeds and Leeds Met. I think I'm still on the books, but I'm not on the payroll anymore. But some dentists told me what it really means. Edentate means without teeth, so you can work out what emeritus means. And you can also work out what e-learning means, because so often it is without learning, it's e-information. That's another story, that's another day's workshop. I'm now worrying about e-quality, but there we are. As I said, you will be able to download my main slides. I'll put them up on my website later on today. But without photos and links, etc., otherwise it would be too big a file size. So, intended outcomes. By 11 o'clock, I hope you'll be better able to do four things. Step back and think afresh about how students really learn. And throw out some of the older ideas that don't work about students, how students learn, and maybe replace them with one or two newer ideas that one could do. And identify and address in your own work with students seven factors underpinning successful learning. We'll be linking on to assessment and feedback and things to do with that. And if we have time, I'd like to get into a bit of making feedback and assessment work better. And for some of you who will be going on to complete your FHEA applications, I hope one or two of the ideas might spark off things in your own minds that you want to put in into that particular framework. So that's the intentions by 11 o'clock. Wanted just a little bit about sources, and some of this might be relevant to filling in your forms as well. One of my favourite books is 9 years old now. The late Peter Knight and Mance York wrote this on assessment, learning and employability. It's quite a provocative book. Do any of you know it, in fact? Some people nodding. The thing that's about this is it links to employability. It links to what employers expect of graduates and that sort of thing, and is very sharp about assessment as well. Again, 9 years ago, Marion Bowell interviewed about 100 students that came into university from non-traditional backgrounds and wrote a book around their experience. My favourite book of last year is Flint and Johnson, Australian book, Towards Fairer University Assessment. This was actually an early friend's PhD, and the supervisor was Bruce Johnson, and they produced this book based on her thesis, recognising the concerns of students. And although it doesn't have anything to do with teaching in the title, it's one of the best things to pick up for ideas about teaching, because there's all sorts of things between the lines there about teaching. For a provocative look at assessment, Graham Gibbs can't be beaten, really, and that's one of many, many things he wrote. You probably already know seven propositions for assessment reform that came out from David Bowd et al. A couple of years ago on the Australian Learning and Teaching website. This is having a huge influence now in Australia, New Zealand, Hong Kong, Singapore, and more in the UK as well. It's only four pages, but it really gets to grips with what's wrong with assessment and what we need to do. Another Australian that is well worth a read, Gordon Jochen, just a little booklet on a short guide to oral assessment. Gordon Jochen is a lawyer working at UQ in Brisbane, and he reckons written assessment misses the boat on several things. And we've got too much written assessment around, and we need to rebalance the books. So for a very focused account on that, have a look at Gordon Jochen. You probably already know the work of Jeff Petty. Anyone who's spent any time in EFI will certainly know the work of Jeff Petty. He's hugely in demand, and his bestseller is called Teaching Today, which sells far more than anything I've ever written. But evidence-based teaching is also a really good read. And Jeff is one of these people who thinks we're at a time of change now. It's a bit like the revolution that's happened in medical education and in medicine in general, that we're changing to an evidence-based approach rather than the historical approach. And finally, on this list of things I recommend you do have a look at, this one's completely free, Blue Skies from Pearson. Pearson asked, you can just go to their website, you download it, they asked about 37 of us to give about 1,000 words of what we thought was crucial at this particular point, or last year's particular point in the development of higher education, after the white paper and everything else came out. And my wife Sally Brown is there, I'm in there, David Willett is in there, Aaron Porter's in there, there's all sorts of people, there's parents, VCs, governors, all arguing with each other in their 1,000 words, etc., all having different points of view, but it gets you thinking. And also on the website, you can listen to a number of people speaking for about a minute or 2 minutes. And the one not to miss is Aaron Porter from last year. Very intelligent and sharply focused little 2 minutes about the student perception of higher education at this particular point. Things I've written include these. You've probably seen these around. And don't tell the publishers, but there's quite a lot of these bits that you can download from my website, because I'd much rather people use things than they sat on the library shelf. And what we'll be doing this morning is basically in chapter 2 and a bit of chapter 1 of Making Learning Happen, and other things are in there as well. So, I've talked long enough now. There are post-its on the table. Will you all grab a post-it? Has everyone got a post-it? So, on this post-it, in your best handwriting, there's a reason for this, in your best handwriting, write your own short completion of this starter. Teaching would be much better for me, if only I. Your own ending to that starter. No more than 300 words. Now, why did I say in your best handwriting? This is why. I want you now to swap post-its, so you've no idea who's got yours. So, wander around, swap post-its. So, let's have a sample of these post-its. Have you all got somebody else's now? Right. Last person standing, seems to be either you or she, read out with passion and drama what's on the post-it you now have.
Teaching would be much better for me if only I knew exactly what my students wanted, not what they say they want.
Right, lovely one, whoever wrote that. If you'd now pick somebody on this table, please.
I'll pick on Bill.
Okay.
Okay, you can take a seat again.
Had more time.
How many of you have those three words on the post-it you've now got? So, had more time is a very common answer, right? Okay, if you'd pick somebody on this table halfway up.
Okay, there you go.
Had more time to prepare my sessions.
Right. Pick somebody on the next table up.
If I knew what I was talking about.
Brilliant. Does help. Good. Well done, whoever wrote that one. Okay, thanks. Pick one of your four colleagues there.
And had more time to plan innovative activities.
Uh-huh. Pick somebody on this table, Damien.
Good friend, Penny.
Knew what students took away from it.
Uh-huh, indeed, good one. Pick somebody, there's plenty of choice on this table around here. Pick anybody you like there.
Rebecca.
Who'd manage time more effectively.
Right. Rebecca, you pick anybody in the room who hasn't spoken, who's trying to avoid eye contact with you.
They're all looking at me.
You see, it's one way of getting full attention.
Well, Pam looked at me more intently than anyone.
Could choose the subject.
Right, right. What I'd like you to do now is to stick them all... Now, I did have a chart stuck to the wall there. It seems to have fallen off. If you stick them all on this chart on the wall, send a runner from your table. We'll have an exhibit of all of these. Right, thanks very much. I'll just have a quick look at things that we haven't heard. A lot of them, of course, say had more time. Understood some of the students' mentality better, someone says. Right at the top, knew what I was talking about. Love that one. Time to prepare.
That one's interesting, though.
Which one?
That one there, that's a bit different.
This one?
Yeah.
Only I could spend more time doing my research to invest in the pedagogy, I think it says. Yeah? Good. You're more about students' prior learning experience. And, of course, this is a way of finding out a bit about students' prior learning experience. Ask them what their if-onlys are with something. I use posters for all sorts of things. And it's a non-threatening space for students or for ourselves. And if you're wanting to find out what's going on in a room full of students, getting them to jot something down is not threatening. And you get the views of the ones who wouldn't speak up in a group, as it were. Getting them then to swap post-its, they've got the comfort of anonymity, and there's no danger reading out somebody else's post-it. If it's silly, it's not their fault. And it's a way of finding out where people are coming from. And I've just got the word economics on that slide. You can, as you can see, get an exhibit quite quickly. It's a way of finding out what the real intended outcomes are in a group, but also what they're bringing with them, the learning incomes. Everybody talks about intended learning outcomes, but I think learning incomes are just as important, if not more important. The things the students already know, the things the students can already do, the experience they've got, and the baggage they've got as well. Well, I use thousands of post-its with staff and with students. The student sent me a picture of what he reckoned my room must look like. And another student sent me a warning what never to do with post-its. Now, I've never done this, but I'll pass on the warning. There's obviously a post-it website out there somewhere. Now, teaching is very often a face-to-face activity. One-to-one, large group, small group, whatever, face-to-face. Got a little exercise for you now on face-to-face communication skills. This is called 30-second theatre. Have any of you done this with me before? No? Right, all the better. It's very short. In a moment, I want you to wander around the room again, working in pairs, different pairs, using this very short script that follows. And the first two bits of the script, just greet each other by name if you know the person's name, which I'm sure you will, in whatever way you normally would. But then the first person in the encounter says those three words, and the second person replies with those two words. That's it. That's all the script is. But do this quite differently with different people. Different body language, different gesture, different eye contact, different tone of voice, different way of saying the words. Do it quite differently. So on one occasion, it could be someone who's just fixed your car. On another occasion, you could imagine you're talking to your vice-chancellor. On another occasion, maybe our friend David Willetts, the Minister of Higher Education. You know, anybody who comes into mind, you can just make them as different as you can. So, wander around for half a minute or so. Off you go. Thank you. Your name?
I know.
Sorry, then.
No.
No. No. Hello.
Hello.
You're right.
No. Hello. Hello. You're late.
I'm on that. I know.
Hello. Hello. I know.
Hello.
Hello.
You are late.
Okay, if you take your seats again now, please. Thank you. Right. Now, as you could hear, even with just a few words like that, there's a lot of very different ways of saying them. You did this brilliantly. I heard all sorts of different ways of saying these words. You might have wondered what the sound was I used when I wanted you to stop doing this. And I often do this with large groups, you know, maybe 300 or 400 people at a conference or something like that. When you've got 400 people doing what you're just doing, imagine how loud it is in an auditorium. So you've got to have a sound to attract their attention when you want them to stop. And in my retirement, this is part of my research, to find out what sound will stop a large group of people doing this exercise. And this is quite a promising sound, the one you heard, but it's a very early stage. That is metal bread knife on glass, metal on empty Australian Jacobs Creek Shiraz. There's a lot more research to be done before I know I've got this right, so I'll continue working on this, you know, as I can. Incidentally, I once did this with 400 Australians, and it went just like you, they really entered into it. But then, 10 minutes later, a delegate arrived late to the conference. And 400 Australians all chorused, "You're late." So, you know, if anybody does come in, I'll leave it to you. I'll leave it to you. Now, this actually is quite a serious... There's a serious point behind this exercise. Face-to-face communication, whether it's large group, small group, one-to-one, whatever, we've got all of those things in the bullet points, and many more. Tone of voice, body language, gesture. We've got all of those things. Things that we haven't got on a course web page, a module handbook, or a handout. And when it comes to the things at the top of the slide, the assessment criteria, the evidence of achievement of learning outcomes, what the outcomes actually mean, those are the things students really, really need to see our lips, hear our voices, see our eyes. Putting these things up in words on a screen or a web page or a handout doesn't work. Statement 5 of the National Student Survey, the assessment criteria were clear in advance. And all over the country, people are saying, no, they weren't. And we're saying, yes, they are. They're in the module handbook. They're on the course web page. They don't work there. When students look at them there, they have to still hear our voices, see our faces. They have to know what these things mean by us having explained them, etc. And especially evidence of achievement. What exactly students need to do to get a first or to get a 2-1 or a 2-2, they really need to keep hearing this, seeing this, every time they see us, as it were. This is the hardest part of distance learning, to actually get those things through. But of course you can still have audio files or video files where these things are being explained. Right. Well, here's a gloomy slide for you. Now is the decade of our discontent. But what I'm actually getting at is about content. Never mind the content. Never mind the subject. Feel the learning. And our friend David Willetts, in his bit on Blue Skies, says this, with the bottom line that I put into red, they will demand more in return. Students are going to be expecting an awful lot more from us when they're paying 3 times as much as they used to pay. And it goes back to the previous slide, especially when it comes to assessment and feedback and those sorts of things. And what do you get for 9K or for 27K? Those are some of the cars that you can buy for 9K or 27K. And, of course, anybody who's spending those sorts of sums of money are going to be looking for service standards, warranties, guarantees. Students are going to be much sharper in their expectations of their experience of higher education, the ones that are paying these fees, than they were last year. And there's a bit of car recognition, if anyone... These are all 9K cars, and these are all 27K cars. But higher education is changing very rapidly now. It used to be that students would come to Sheffield Hallam for the subject expertise, for the content, for the research, etc. Well, the research is everywhere now. You can go online and get most of it free, in fact, from Harvard, MIT, anywhere you want. What students come to higher education, what they pay for in higher education, is two things that aren't the content. One of them is recognising and accrediting their achievement. In other words, getting the assessment right. And the other is they come into higher education institutions for support in their learning, for company and feedback. So feedback is critically important now, as well as getting the assessment right. Sorry about that. It's therefore time to rethink three things. How students really learn. How we can make learning happen for them. How to make feedback really work for students. And how best to measure and accredit students' experience. And I've got in brackets not just more of the same old tired methods. And the same old tired methods in my mind, those of you that read my website, include essays, exams and reports. There's loads of research on essays, exams and reports about the authenticity, the transparency, the validity, the reliability. They're all very dangerously adrift when it comes to making assessment really work. There's a lot wrong with those. We're going to have to change. So we'll touch on these things as we go through this session. And just focusing back on assessment, we still try to measure, as we should, what's in students' heads, what they can do with what's in their heads, in terms of two unsatisfactory proxies. There's still too much of this in UK higher education. What comes out of their pens in exams? Now, how good a measure is what comes out of one of these on a bit of that stuff of what's in a head? There's usually a lot more in a head than ever gets out onto the paper. And of course, with a pen, you can't rearrange the beginning to lead into what you've already written in the middle and this sort of thing. There's all sorts of... It's archaic. It's a 200 years old way of communicating things. We're going to have to move away from this because students are much less likely to use these things than they used to be. And so are we, in fact. Now, there are one or two people who have pens that are cleverer than their heads, but they become David Willetts and David Cameron. You know, there are exceptions to every rule. The other unsatisfactory proxy is what comes out of their keyboards. Now, I'm much happier, and so are most students, using a keyboard and using a pen these days, because you can rearrange it, you can spell check it, you can restructure it, you can edit it on screen, etc. If you've got 20 students, I'm not worried. Because you know your students. You know that what comes out of their keyboard did come out of their fingers. If you've got 200 students, you don't. Students are ahead of us. Steve Newstead down at Plymouth University has the knack of asking students how they cheat. And they tell him. And there are students who will download something from the web translate it into Spanish, Spanish to German, German back to English, get through all this plagiarism detective software, no problem at all. And it's quicker than thinking of it for themselves. So we've got 200 students. Some of them will do things like that. So what comes out of their keyboards? Whose fingers was it? You've got to have ways of triangulating. And of course, when it comes to assessment, this is the big danger with anything big. A 3,000-word essay, a 10,000-word dissertation, or whatever. The bigger it is, the more likely that it mightn't have come from their fingers. If it's a 200-word argument, exactly 200 words or something like that, it doesn't happen. The students will write it. Shorter assessments, shorter, sharp, focused assessments work well. Longer ones are not good, and we can't mark them anyway. All the research shows that 3,000-word essays, we're lousy at marking them. The reliability is terrible. Anyway, look at Fintan Johnson if you want a bit more backing on there, and indeed Graham Gibbs. Well, I want in a moment to think of how we get things into students' heads, but not before showing you this. Lewis Carroll in 1893. And the bottom line, and nobody has a ghost of an idea what it means. This still happens. The students are still churning things out, because that's always been what's happened, as it were. Life is too short. We can't do this any longer. I also want to challenge one or two of the older ways of thinking about learning, that nobody knows what they mean either. So, back to learning. Now, some of you will have heard me talk about seven factors underpinning successful learning. How many of you have heard me talk about these before? So, a few of you have. Basically, what I've done in the last 20 years, I've now asked over 120,000 people some questions about how they learn. Straightforward questions, and drawn from their answers factors that underpin successful learning. And I'm going to take you quickly through some of these questions, see what your answers are, and then show you what the most common answers are, and then how we can address the factors that emerge. But before we do that, little written, very short exercise for you. I'm going to put a quote on the screen. Don't say anything. These are not my words. These are somebody else's words. On any bit of paper, just jot down who you think wrote this. You might know who wrote this, or just guess, but everyone guess. So, 15 seconds for you all to guess. I quite often do this little exercise with a big group in a conference. And I can usually see in a conference there are people sitting at the back whose pens never move and hands never move. If I were to say to a conference audience, hands up those of you who haven't written down your guess, the hands wouldn't move. What I do say to a conference audience is, hands up anyone who's sitting beside someone who hasn't written down their guess. And quite a few hands go up. And I'll try this with you today. Hands up anyone who's sitting beside someone who hasn't written down their guess. I've got one or two hands up. This is where I take a seat and say, nothing more happens till they've all written down their guess. I've got all day. Bit of peer pressure. We'll try again. I hope you don't have it. It gets a bit messy now if you haven't. Is there anyone still sitting beside someone who hasn't written down their guess? Oh, we've got somebody back there. I'm afraid I'm going to have to come along and sort them out. So who's the person who hasn't written down their guess? Right. Is it you?
No.
So, sorry?
You've all done
it now. It's amazing how when you get a bit closer, it's a compliance model of the inverse square of the distance from the lecturer, you know. Yeah. Right. So, many of you will have guessed this right. Someone on this table, give me what your guess was or what you put down anyway. You're absolutely right. Well done. So, how many other people put Einstein down. Yes, several other people put Einstein down. Now, when I said to your colleague, well done, you're right, did you feel pleased? Did you feel pleased?
Yeah, very.
And did you feel pleased? Yeah. You felt pleased because you were getting feedback on something you'd done correctly. Now, it was just a guess. So anyone who didn't get it right, I don't think you'd feel mortally wounded or anything. It was just a guess. It didn't matter. But it's a point about feedback. Feedback only works after students have done something. It doesn't work when they've just sat and thought. They've got to have done something for feedback to work. And I've watched lecturers who will work with a class. They'll ask a question, large group or whatever, wait for 7 seconds, and then answer their own question. And the students are sitting there thinking, he's just asked another question. Hang on, he'll answer it, then I'll write it down. I've seen lecturers who ask a question, wait a few seconds, and then pick somebody. And the students are all sitting there thinking, he's just asked another question. Don't make eye contact. Don't look interested. Don't look bored. Just look blank. And he'd probably pick somebody else. Feedback only works after action. This is why I call my book Making Learning Happen. We've got to use every trick in the book to cause students to do things. The human default position is to sit and wait for it to happen, as it were. And we've got to get over that with large groups, small groups. Every time we see this, we've got to get them doing something. Otherwise, we're wasting our time, we're wasting their time. I think I've got another Einstein quote. If you can't explain something simply enough, you don't know enough about it. You don't really understand something unless you can explain it to your grandmother. Now, sadly, I haven't got a grandmother left now, but, you know, it's a point worth making. Right. 10 most important words in teaching and research and reflection. Have I done these with any of you before? Because I'm going to ask you what the 10th one is. First 6 are unsurprising. If people are learning something, they become able to answer questions like those about whatever it is. Why, what, who, where, when, how. Some of you might know these as Kipling 6. If Kipling had been looking for 7, he might well have used that one. Number 8 is a phrase rather than a word. So what? Students are sitting there. As are we, very often. So what? Will the sky fall in if I go onto Facebook for 2 minutes? Will the sky fall in if I text my mates? There's no saying don't do it, they just do it under the bench then. We can't stop them doing these things. If we've got them riveted to what we're talking about, it doesn't happen. But when it's not, they do these things. They look at anything else that's entertaining, you know, look out the window, etc. I'm really pleased here, actually. You've got a wonderful device that, if I get bored, this keeps showing me things, you know. So I've got my equivalent of this. The wow factor. But that's 9. The most important four-letter word in the English language isn't on there yet. And I'm going to ask you what this is in a minute or two. But one of the 9 is less important than it was. A lot less important. This one. What is getting ever less important? And last year, Columbia University research showed people are much less prepared to remember what. They remember where they put it. They remember that they downloaded it onto their hard disk or their external drive or their memory stick or whatever. Betsy Sparrow's leading this team. Internet, she says, has become an internal memory source. And if you want to follow the links, you can when you download these slides. Well, back to these words with a bit of context this time. If you're designing a bit of curriculum, why you include something? There's got to be a good rationale for that, a good reason for putting that in. And of course, this links to applying for FHEA as well. You've got to be showing that you're making decisions about the importance of things to include in the curriculum with students, that there's a good rationale there. What is the content is less important, as I said, but people remain even more important than they used to be. Us, our students, employers, supervisors, clients, patients, and so on. Where and when, learning happens at all sorts of times and places. Most institutions nowadays, I'm sure you're among them, have 365, 24/7 learning resource availability, etc. How, though, really critical ones about processes. And I want us to move on in a little while to how learning happens. The processes, not the what, but the how. Which about decisions? So what about priorities, relative importance? Wow is about impact. When you get your alumni back, and we're recording this for alumni, always ask, what was the single thing you took away that really made a difference to your life, to your career, to your job, everything? Those are the things with the impact. And those listening on the alumni recording might think about this. You might want to email someone with what the single most important, useful thing you took away was. But we've still got this missing word. Now, what I normally do is give an audience 4 minutes and 12 yes-no questions. That's become the benchmark. Half the places I go to get this missing four-letter word by using 12 or less yes-no questions to me in 4 or less minutes. So you can confer when someone's ready to put in one question, just raise a hand and I'll answer it yes or no. Over to you. At 10:25, I'll say time's up. The reputation of Sheffield Hallam is on the line now. I've got a question, good.
Is the word next?
No, the word isn't next, but that's a very good question. It's sort of like next, but better.
Does the word begin with W?
The word doesn't begin with W, but it's a good question because it might have, but it doesn't. Yeah. So you've had two.
Well done, Liz.
Yeah.
Is it about outcomes?
No, you've had
it's
three.
An action
word. No, it's not an action word, and it's not about outcomes, that's four.
Not about outcomes.
Does it start with T?
No, it doesn't start with T, that's five. It doesn't start with S, that's six.
Does it relate to personal development?
Not in any direct way, no. Seven.
Is it reflection?
Follow the word. I won't penalise you with that one. We've had seven. It's about reflection as well. It's about next as well.
Goal.
No. That's eight. You've been through quite a few consonants. It's quite a useful question, the one you didn't ask. Does it begin with a vowel? The answer would have been yes.
Ergo.
No, but you've got the right vowel. So that is nine, you've got the right vowel.
Easy.
No, ten. It has got an S in it, though. It's got two E's and an S in it.
Else.
Yep, you got it. You got it in time. Well done. So the reputation of Sheffield Hallam is safe. The best teacher I ever saw in Ireland, I remember, she had people in the room rather like this, about six to a table, about 40 odd in the room. And she came in this particular afternoon. She'd already given them some case studies to look at the week previous. And she came and she walked up to one table and she said, "Case study A. What was going on in case study A?" And the students around this table filled her in with all sorts of things going on in case study A. She thanked them. She said, "Yep, really good." She then went to another table. Case study A. What else was going on? They had to think harder because there's already been a really good answer from there. They did. They thought harder. They thought of some more things. She thanked them. Case study A. What else was going on? She went right round. And then she started with a group at the back. Case study B, why did so-and-so happen? They gave a reason. Why else? Why else? Etc. The word else is really important in most of these other questions. If you're asking a group of students, if you're probing something, and you ask a question like why, what, how, why else? What else? How else? Etc. Now, a bad old exam question could be, list and explain six causes of so-and-so. Much better question is, three causes of so-and-so are blob, blob, and blob. What else causes so-and-so? It could be a shorter question, a sharper question, a more discriminating question, etc. So, after today, incidentally, I won't put this slide on my website, I never do. You've got to remember that word, or else the people that I see next week would know what the four-letter word is. So that's never been on my website, nor has this slide. But that's what we've got to do, though. In thinking about assessment and thinking about feedback and thinking about learning, we've got to think of how else can we address these things. So, when you're filling in your FHEA thing, you know, there's references to scholarship. I'm a bit worried about this scholarship, though. There's a little verse somebody gave me. And we've probably all seen lecturers who had this knack of turning something very straightforward into something that looked very difficult. And this is accused to a lecturer in Bath at about 1975. And one of his students says she wants her students to leave her lectures nowadays saying, "Yeah, I knew that already. And I just hadn't thought about it that way. And particularly, I can do that." That's Deborah Jane from Bath. So, how you learn? What you need now is another post-it. And turn your new post-it into a little grid with four boxes. So, you've got four boxes, one, two, three, four. Before we start the questions, if your birthday is January, February or March, ring number one. If your birthday is April, May or June, ring number two. July, August, September, ring number three. October, November, December, ring number four. I'll just check I've got the right numbers for this to work. How many of you ring number one? Yeah, that'll do. Number two? Plenty of twos, good. Number three, right. Number four, number five, good. Right. So these questions are in two parts. I only want you to write down in the boxes your answer to the second part of each question, and in no more than six words or so. So here's question one, the first part just to think about. Think of something you know you do well. Anything at all in your life. Something you do well. Could be a hobby, could be a sport, could be academic, could be professional. Something you know you do well. I'm not going to ask you what it is. But in box one, just a few words. How did you become good at it? In box one. No, the first part's just to think about. Put your answer to the second part of the question in box one. I did have it on the previous slide. I didn't leave it up long enough. Put your answer to the second part of each question in the boxes. No more than six words. Right. So, people who have number one ringed, I'm going to ask them what they put in the box. Now, most of the people who have number one ringed will volunteer, but people sitting beside someone who has people one ringed point at them just to make sure I get everyone with number one. Right. Yeah, I've got a number one here, yes, I can tell. Yes. What did you put in the box, Alison?
I put lots of practice.
I'm glad you put that.
And wanting to do it.
Uh-huh. Great. I'll put practice up for the moment. Thanks for that. Right, have we a number one? Yes, that's number one.
Practice,
great. Any more ones on this table? Yeah. Right? Any ones on this table?
Practice and asking how when I got stuck.
Uh-huh, nice. Any ones on this table? Any ones here? Mark, please.
By using my imagination.
Uh-huh.
Reading and practicing.
Uh-huh. Any ones there? Well, the things that keep coming up, practice is by far the most common, but also trial and error, doing something, having a go, repetition often comes into the practice, experimenting, but many, many other things. But those things are always there when you do this with a large group, especially practice. Well, here's a quote. One must learn by doing the thing. Though you think you know it, you have no certainty until you try. 2,500 years old, that one. We've known that for a long time, that learning happens by doing, and the ancient Chinese as well. Here's a more obscure quote. Definition of an expert. Someone who's made all the mistakes which can be made with a twist in the tail in a very narrow field. This one's the Danish nuclear physicist of last century, Niels Bohr. But we need to get students getting things wrong. We need to help them to get things wrong in the right place so that they can learn from their mistakes. And I say to new lecturers, you know, the lecture theatre is where you want your students to get everything wrong that they could get wrong when it doesn't matter, when there's plenty of fun around, so that in practice, in fieldwork, in work-based placements, they don't get these things wrong. Perfectly natural to get things wrong. Little illustration of that. I'm sure you know these. Don't be sorry for the penguin. The water is going to be 11 Celsius warmer than the ice or the air or more. And there's probably fish underneath, so penguin's heading for lunch. Doesn't look as though it's expecting lunch somehow. Well, where do we come in? And fellow students, we need to help people to get things wrong. There's no sound on this one. You've got to look quite carefully at this one. This is our job. In whatever subject we're working with, we know where the holes in the ice are. We need to help students find the holes in the ice at the right time, at the time when it's not going to be humiliating, it's not going to be dangerous, it's going to be useful. Obviously, somebody did some video editing on there. We've got to be a bit careful, though, and not do it like this. This is the last penguin. Not subtle enough. Next to feelings. And this is where the educational psychologists messed up in the last half century, I think, by going into cognition and metacognition and all those sorts of things. If you like that, fine. Much more important, feelings. And you may well have come across Alan Mortiboy's from Birmingham, his work on emotional intelligence following Daniel Goleman's work in the States. There's Alan. So, question two is about feelings. The first part of question two I want you just to think about. Second part, write in box number two. That's the first part. Think of something you feel good about, something you're proud of, something, personal attribute, quality. I'm not going to ask you what it is, you're perfectly safe, but just identify something that you're proud of. Have you all got something in mind? In box two, just a few words. Basically, how can you tell? How can you justify, upon what evidence is this feeling based? So I now need your help in finding the people who ring number two, if they tend to be hiding. Have we any twos on the back table here? Right. What did you put in the box?
Feedback from others.
I'm so glad you put that. Can I put that straight up? Right. That's the most common, the most prevalent reaction. Great, thanks for that. Have we a number two on this table? You're a number two, I believe.
I am two. I just can't quite put it into words.
Ah, right. Another number two?
Yeah, I'm number two. Same. Because sort of, yeah.
You can't put it into words?
Well, I'm struggling with it because it's sort of...
depending on what you chose.
Depending on what you choose to feel good about, which I'm struggling with.
Ah, because, well, I mean, if... you could be very good about your modesty if you can't find anything to feel good about, you know. Yeah. So we'll move from there. Right, number two on this table. Good.
Again, same as everyone. Feedback from tutors.
Yeah. Good. Number two on this table.
Because people have told me so.
Yeah. Yeah. Any number twos on this table?
People's reaction and feedback.
Yeah.
Because it's effortless and time flies.
Right. Right. That's a good one. That. And, you know, another thing that often comes up is praise. One that's usually there, but less common, is gaining confidence. Now, one of John Cowan's statements is, confidence is the single most important predeterminant of success. Now, if we can get our students confident, they're more likely to succeed. And if we can get confident, we're more likely to teach well, of course. And another one that's actually quite common is just seeing the results, seeing the effects. There's many, many more things besides these. Well, my favourite quote about feedback is like fish. If it's not used quickly, it becomes useless, it goes off. That's my better half, Sally Brown. And old Chinese proverb. One of our main responsibilities is to help our students become better at looking for feedback, getting feedback, finding feedback. And the speed of feedback is really important. The faster, the better. This one comes from Denmark. Now, we don't want students to put loads and loads of work in and then find they've been doing the wrong thing. We don't want, with our teaching or curriculum design, to put loads of time in and find we're doing the wrong thing, etc. We need feedback to sort us out. One thing I love about working in Australia is they have no sanctity for proverbs, and they've changed the Chinese one. Anyway. Oops, didn't want to do that. Sorry about that. Opportune, though. That's where your slides will be when I put them up. They'll be above National College of Ireland, which I did yesterday, and they'll be below the thing I do next, etc. But they appear at the top and things go down. Now I'll have to find out where I was again. So bear with me. This is recapitulation. You can think your way all the way through these things. And we've done the feelings bit. We've done that one. So, question three. What can go wrong? So, this is a bit just to think about. Don't write anything. Think of something you're not good at. Anything at all. And I'll then ask you what to do about that thing. But this is optional, this one. If there's nothing in this category, just sit with your hands on your head for a minute. No? No. Right. So we've all got something in mind. In box three, a few words about what went wrong, who, if anybody, was to blame? Mightn't be anybody to blame, but sometimes there is. What went wrong? Who, if anybody, was to blame? So, the people with number three ringed can relax. I don't want to be predictable. I'm going to pick the number fours. So, number fours on this table. Please?
So, lack of patience.
Uh-huh, lack of patience, great. Any more number fours?
Four, yeah. Disengagement.
Disengagement, right. Any fours on this table?
It didn't work.
Didn't work, good. Any fours on this table?
Poor teacher and impatient attitude.
Poor teacher, I'm glad somebody said that. How many of you were thinking of a poor teacher or instructor or trainer? Quite a few. In how many cases, if any, was that a poor maths teacher? Quite a few, yeah, often is. Right, any number fours on this table?
Yeah, teacher,
but
it was physics rather than...
Right, yeah. Maths, physics and French are the common ones, yep. Any number fours there? Right. Please?
Humiliation and sarcasm if you got it wrong.
Right. That's actually a more common answer than we would hope it to be, you know. And there's probably somebody should have been struck off that sort of attitude. Yep. Good. Thanks for those. These are the views of a particular group of students. Lack of engagement. Didn't really want to learn it. Sometimes because they couldn't see the point. They couldn't see why. The rationale, bad teaching we've come across. Also, students will say, well, I just couldn't get my head around it. The light bulb wouldn't dawn, etc. Well, do you ever walk in to a class of students, especially on a Monday, and look around their faces and say, you know, have you brought your heads with you today? Have you been there? That's the time we need to ask which station we're broadcasting on. And the one that works is that one, WIIFM. It's an analog station, not a digital one. Anybody know it? What's in it for me? The students are sitting there thinking, what's in it for me? We've got to warm up their want to learn. We've got to make it relevant. We've got to show them where it's going to take them, what the benefits are, where it's useful. Question four. This is a bit just to think about. Something you did learn successfully, but at the time you didn't want to. But you did succeed. All sorts of things. This could be learning to drive, learning to swim, learning to iron, learning to cook, SPSS, there's all sorts of things. So if you've got something in that category, and not everybody has, in box four, just put a few words down what kept you going. Now what I'm going to do this time is I'm going to put three answers up and then get you all to vote. Some people, what kept them going was this. Others, it was things like this. And yet others, it was things about necessity. So I'd like you all to decide what you put in box four, which of those three is closest to what you put there. And show of hands, those whose box four was closest to that one. Quite a few, right? This one, again, quite a few. And this one, right, the majority. If you do this with a large group of students, it's about 1 in 10, surprisingly lower than you'd think. 3 in 10, surprisingly more than we'd think. And about 6 in 10, about what you'd think. Well, that leads to the first five of the seven factors underpinning successful learning. Answers to those questions. But in English, not in academies or Kwahili, etc. Doing. Practice, trial and error, repetition. Feedback. Other people's reactions, seeing the results, praise, criticism. Wanting to learn. Now, I no longer bother with the words intrinsic motivation, which means exactly the same as wanting to learn. Only one out of my 120,000 people so far has replied to any of my questions, I was intrinsically motivated, thank you, Phil. That is not normal. Nor do I bother with extrinsic motivation anymore. I must admit, six out of my 120,000 people so far have said extrinsic motivation, but six in 120,000 isn't normal, really. We all know what wanting means and what needing means, and so do our students. Then, getting one's head around it, making sense. Now, going back a step, you have probably come across language like this. I put it in an old font, because it's old, and it's not very successful. And when you look at it, it's adjectives and nouns, adjectives and nouns, adjectives and nouns. When you go back to what real people put, it's actions, verbs, participles, doing, making sense, wanting, etc. And I've sometimes asked people just to give me a quick demo of the bottom one. Because nobody has the ghost of an idea what it means. Everybody's got their own idea, but it's all different. It's not a useful concept. And you've probably seen them like this. Have you seen them like this? Bad idea. Mistaken thinking. Messed up education and training for decades. Also, if you think about it, think of those two. I once had a room full of people. I got the people on one side to work out what this was and flip chart word pictures. The people on the other side to do the other one. We brought them together. They're just the same. It's only they're the same thing. And I once gave another room full of people a post-it each. Tell me what concrete experience is. Concrete experience. Now, being a scientist, I took the post-its away and analysed them for statistically significant words and phrases. And there were three statistically significant words to do with concrete experience are as follows: sand, cement, and gravel. Well, what's missing in that cycle? There's no feelings. No wonder it didn't work. There's no rationale, there's no want, there's no need. Missing. No people in there. It's abstract. More important, more sinister, there's not any communication in there. Now, students come to Hallam to get degrees in this, that and the other. They don't get degrees in the subject. They get degrees in what comes out about the subject, the practice and communication of, etc. We can't give them degrees on what's in the heads. We can only give them degrees on what they do, what they show us, what they write, what they say, etc. But communication is missing from that cycle. Fatal. There's no emotions in there. Now, I'm afraid, you know, we're not as civilised in Newcastle as you are in Sheffield. If there's something with no emotions in, we say Asperger's with bells on. There's no judgment in there. You can't pick it up and run with it. Well, I'm not the only person to say this is a load of claptrap, as it were. The government occasionally does something sensible. The previous government asked Coffield et al. To look at the muddy water underpinning post-compulsory education. They published this in 2004. How many of you know this? Probably quite a few here. Good. And you'll know that they said, following Veerstra and de Jong, the cycle may be seriously flawed. It's worse than that. And enduring and frustrating lack of clarity, particularly when it comes to abstract conceptualising. Those are the authors. Now, it's the present government, of course. Are there any windows that are open that could be shut? Or I'll come a bit nearer the back. Right. I can always come to the naughty table, you say. Which is, but I did that. I know. Sorry about that. They also said on learning styles, should research be discontinued? They were following Reynolds there. Well, back to Einstein. Simply madness to keep doing the same thing and expect different results. Don't want to get in your way either. Simply madness to keep using the same thinking about learning and expect to make it work. Simply madness to keep using the same design of assessment, especially essays and reports, and exams and expect to put things right with the student experience of higher education. Simply madness to keep using the same way of giving feedback that doesn't work. We found it out from the National Student Survey year after year after year. Feedback on paper, on their work, doesn't work. Well, I'm getting interested in WP, but of course the last government it was widening participation. Now it's we only think of it in terms of work and play. But both are learning by doing. Work often links to needing to learn. Play often links to wanting to learn. And the thing that characterises play, I want to keep doing this. I don't want to stop. Please, can I stay here? And so on. Well, there's my granddaughter on the beach in March, would you believe, that warm week we had. She's 2.5, and she was playing. There was a pool just to her right, and she was making sandcastles for the first time, really. And she found that dry sand just fell down. She found that really wet sand just splashed out again. Before long, she'd worked out, you put so much water, so much sand in, you got a good sandcastle. But that was play. She didn't want to come away, and indeed we stayed there all day. We need to do more of play in higher education, especially when it comes to blended learning. There needs to be a lot of play at the end. Got to make our lectures fun as well. Have you seen this quote about lectures? People have been saying this for a long time. There's a picture, the oldest one I can find about lectures. The geography is similar. The costumes are different. But when you download this, the facial expression is very similar. And there's a engraving Hogarth. See the fun the lecturer's having? Look at all their faces, though. And of course, Hogarth, all of these will be people who knew each other. Well, sometimes it works. But there's a group of students in a studio who had a big sound desk. They're really engaged when you look at their faces. They're doing stuff. Somebody who's got it there. I won't put these pictures on my website, by the way, because I haven't asked all these people's permission. There's a lecture room not that far away from here, somewhere else in Yorkshire, that doesn't work. There's somewhere that does work. Well, would this be a cycle? And the answer is no. Everything should be as simple as possible, but not simpler. That's what went wrong, thinking it was consecutive. And I've argued in things I've written that these factors all affect each other. It might start with a pebble dropping into a pond, if you like, with a want or a need, better still both. How many of you have something on your desk when you get back to it that you want to do or need to do that you haven't done yet and has been there for 6 weeks? Right? How many of you know yourself well enough, in 6 weeks' time you still won't have done it, but you will have forgotten what it was? Age certainly helps there. There's got to be some doing. And this is the heart of our job with students. We've got to get them doing. Now, we want them to make sense, but we can't do that for them. Only they can do that. But we can do this bit. We can make sure the feedback gets to them. But don't think of these as static, as I've got them on the screen. Think of them as bouncing backwards and forwards. I could make them bounce backwards and forwards. That would give us all a headache. But the feedback helps you make sense of what you've just done. The feedback helps you want to do some more of the thing you last did, if you enjoyed the feedback, and so on. These things are all affecting each other. That's why the cycle was such a bad idea, because these things are intimately connected. But there's two things missing. And I've got Australians to thank for getting the rest of the way to the seven factors underpinning successful learning. So, I've got two more pairs of questions. Back to your experience now. Think back to something you've taught for some time, but think back to the first time you did it. Can you all remember your first class or your first lecture? It's amazing how they stay in the mind, isn't it? You know. My question then is, to what extent did you have your own head round it much better after you'd done the first lecture than before the first lecture? Two hands were very much better One hand for somewhat better, no hands for no difference. Go. We've got loads of double hands there. There's another factor. One hasn't learned something till one's done this as well. Communicated it, coached, taught, explained. And working with students, I point out how important this one is for them. They've got to be doing that. They've got to be practicing doing that. And I say to students, you know, if you're preparing for an exam, while there are still exams in the system, if you're preparing for an exam, talk it. Talk to anybody. Friends, family, people at the pub, people at the sports club. Talk it. And I say to students, when you run out of people who listen to you talking it, find a dog. Talk to the dog. Dogs love this, by the way. Dogs will sit and look adoringly at you while you explain economics, thermodynamics, or whatever. The student came back to me. She said, she got a first-class degree in law. She said, it was the dog idea. That's what got me the first-class degree. She said she quickly ran out of people who would listen to her talking law, but the dog loved it. And she said the dog was even ahead of me. Because when she was making up a bit that she didn't understand, the dog would cock its head the other way. The dog could tell when she was making up a bit. Incidentally, if you pass that on to your students, tell them not to do this with a cat. A cat will just sit and look at you. Why are you telling me this? I know this already. You know. But we're still not there. Still haven't learned it. We've done one more thing. So now think back to the first pile of work you marked, the first set of students' work. To what extent, after marking that work, or judging presentations, or watching practice lessons, all sorts of things, to what extent did you know it better after assessing other people's evidence? Again, two hands, one hand, zero for zero hands for how much this helped you learn it better. Two hands, one hand, zero hands. Again, lots of double hands. So there's another factor. We've never really learned something till we've done that as well. Till we've made judgments. Good news for us, we're doing it all the time. We've got to get our students doing it so they learn things properly. And the guru on self and peer assessment, David Bowen, uses the words making informed judgments very often. He says students are not ready to go into the world until they can measure their own work before anybody else measures it, so that they know how they're doing. And for a real Australian, Roy Sadler, who is now the guru on formative feedback, 23 years ago, Royce wrote this. What he's saying is, we've got to get our students learning by making judgments while they're doing things, while they're writing, while they're designing, while they're teaching, whatever else. Well, Royce has now become the guru, as I said, on formative feedback. Go on to Google Scholar, you'll find masses of stuff now. The last 3 years in particular, he's done wonders. He's got a smashing paper on feedback from 2010 is brilliant, and so on. Well, my argument about these factors is as follows. We can address them on a day-to-day basis in our work with students and in our own professional development. We can try to warm up students want to learn. And we can also take time to explain, using tone of voice, body language, gesture, everything, what they need to be able to do, what the intended outcomes are. And just as an example, with a first-year large group of students, what I used to do was give them, on the first session, put a couple of slides up about what the next 6 weeks were going to be about. And then I'd give them two post-its, a pink one and a blue one. Each student had two post-its. I'd say, on the pink post-it, write down a question you don't know the answer to about this topic, something you think's important that you don't know the answer to, that you are looking for the answer to. On the blue post-it, write down the most important thing you already know about the topic. And then I'd say, put the post-its, get them to the wall, but look at the ones that go past you on your way to the wall. I could then come back next week, having taken all the post-its with me, and say, 70 of you had a question like so-and-so. I put a question up on a slide. Who was wanting to know the answer to this question? They would put their hands up if it was their question or something similar. I'd say 16 of you already know the answer to this question. That was on your blue post-it. Hands up those of you who know the answer to this question. The hands would go up. I'd say keep your hands up until three or four people whose question it was reach you. And then just explain to them. So we can get students doing some of these things, responding to their want, responding to their need. Lots of things we can do to get them doing. Feedback needs to be quick and useful. I'd love to stay all day and talk about that, but maybe I'll come back again sometime. The bit we can't do for our students is that. They've got to do this themselves. But we can, as I said before, get them talking to each other, get them explaining. And we can do this. We can get them making informed judgments. And just another story about this. I used to teach a subject where they were writing practical reports, laboratory reports. And the reports were pretty poor in standard. There were some good ones, but a lot of bad ones. And I tried everything I knew to help them to write better reports, but eventually I came up with what worked. And what worked was as follows. I'd have the whole class, 160 students, in a lecture room for an hour, a month before they went into the laboratory. An hour on reports. And I'd give them three reports that I'd pre-prepared. They were typed up rather than handwritten. A typed up good one, a typed up bad one, and an in-between one with strengths and weaknesses. Three reports on different colours of paper. So I'd say, here are three reports. You're going to have to write reports in about 4 weeks' time onwards. On your own, for 5 minutes or so, just work out. There's a good one, a bad one, an indifferent one. Work out which is which. And I'd watch them working this out. When I thought the time was right, I'd say, hold up the good one. That's why I had three different colours of paper. I could tell whether they got it right. Hold up the bad one. And again, they'd almost always got it right. I'd then say, now in threes and fours, work out the detail. What really made this good? What really made that bad? And that sort of thing. I would get their criteria up on a couple of slides, in their words, from round the room. I could usually then say, these couple of slides you've just made are now your report criteria. You've thought of them, they're in your words. You can self-assess against these criteria when you hand it in. And the reports got infinitely better. They tended to be outdoing the good one, in fact. You didn't get ones like the bad one anymore. Now, I'd spent a whole hour with the students getting them to make judgments, basically. They learned far more than if I'd rabbited on for 10 hours about what good reports were. Where did I get the good, the bad, the indifferent reports? From students. If you wrote a good report, I might say to you, do you mind if I anonymise your report and combine it with hers and make a good one for next year, as it were? And you wouldn't say no. Where did I get the bad ones from? From students. But I did this as follows. I had them doing group reports for some things. And suppose four of you were doing a group report. I'd say to all the fours, as well as doing your good report to hand in and get marked, do me a bad one alongside it, just for fun. The bad one won't be marked, but there are prizes for the three most outstanding bad ones. You can get some prizes for students. And the students love doing this. I got some brilliant bad ones from them. And the students would say often, well, we had good fun doing the bad one. It actually made our good one better because we put something in the bad one, then we had to keep checking the good one to make sure it wasn't there and that sort of thing. So you could ask the students permission to use the bad one. Well, time has run out on this, so I'm going to go just back to one important thing. This is a final voting round. Do you now feel enabled to? And two hands equals very much better. One hand, somewhat better. No hands, no better. Have I got you thinking afresh about how students really learn? Two hands, one hand, zero hands? Lots of hands, good. Do you think you're now wanting to address in your own teaching and your own curriculum design those seven straightforward factors underpinning successful learning? Two hands, one hand, zero hands? Right. I've just touched on assessment and feedback, but have I triggered you to think these are something that need fitter's attention in higher education? Two hands, one hand, zero hands? And have I got some things going in your mind now about things you might want to write about the student experience and scholarship with teaching and things to do with the remaining very big important item on your day? Two hands, one hand, zero hands? Right. Well, I'll put my slides up on my website before long. I think if it's okay with Sally, I'll stay around till about lunchtime and you can nobble me on anything you want to, and you know, I'll try to be useful, and then I'll go back to Newcastle. Thank you very much.
Well, from the response.